please host the seminar, as I say, jointly with our friends at Hunt Club, the talk given by Nick McWilliam of Map Action. Nick has a background in the statistical modelling of animal distributions and worked for several years as a lecturer in GIS for biology and ecology. He's also worked for the Precision Anthropic Survey as a data analyst. Nick's worked on humanitarian data analysis, mapping and training for 15 years. This has mainly been for the NGO Map Action, developing the organisation since its start and working on emergency responses in various places such as South Sudan, DRC, Niger, Turkey and Pakistan, capacity building also projects in India, Tanzania and Kazakhstan. Nick also works with NSF, the British Red Cross. Let's pause for my script. Just to note that we do have an NSF linked missing maps party later in the week, so I'll maybe say more about that at the end. But just if you want more, want to contribute, there is an opportunity to do so. So all that exciting stuff, of course, 15 years of such wonderful endeavour couldn't be further removed from 15 years in our own GIS basement. So I, for one, am looking forward to a very interesting seminar. Therefore, please let me introduce Nick McWilliam.
Earlier this year, when Cyclone Idai, very unusually came off the Indian Ocean and impacted Mozambique and Southeast Africa, but much more than any cyclone had done before. The main effect was flooding, as you saw in that picture. Huge areas covered by water, most of the areas that flooded weren't very densely populated, but they still were populated by rural agricultural populations, leading to over 3 million people affected. The definition of affected is obviously what I want to talk about more, but I'm not going to go into that this time. And then there was the cholera outbreak in Beira. So this was like a typical map action mission. 60 members went out in two phases. It was in two phases of about 2 weeks, and this is because the main map action team was made up of volunteers. They're mostly specialists in GIS and related technology, and they have arrangements with their employers or if they're self-employed to phone up their boss and says, I'm off to Mozambique for 2 weeks, is that okay? Usually they have some, you know, they have some arrangement whereby they can do that. Sometimes take meetings holidays, sometimes their company or organization gives it to them. So that's why it's 2 phases and 2 weeks. They were involved with mainly with the UN Humanitarian Coordination Agency. And a lot of the work was to do with gathering data from emergency assessments throughout the country. When you have a huge area like this, actually knowing what the problem is the biggest difficulty. How do you know what's happened over so many thousands, hundreds of thousands of square kilometres? Collating this information and mapping it. I'm afraid this doesn't, you won't be able to see the details. It's shown two themes. This is the sort of map which you can make very early on. This scale, the sort of brown colours are population density estimates. And then the purple and blue colours are the satellite detected floodwaters. So this you can do just within days of the event happening. And you can start to get a very initial guide to where there might be leads. So you're looking at the hazard zone, the population zone, see where you're going, and you know roughly where you're going to need to focus your effort. Some of the maps like this are very mundane. It's no more than an administrative map of Mozambique. It's mundane, but it's actually really important because all the reporting of affected populations and needs and resources is generally done through the country's existing administrative structure, so through the districts or the parishes or whatever the system is. So actually, we spend a lot of time trying to source data for these maps, and I guess it's a problem that other people here have come across before. To overcome the problems of different spellings and different alphabets and character sets and different versions of district names. Even in the UK we have this problem when you get incompatible administrative structures. We use the place name codes, which is a system that's generally organised by the UN Humanitarian Coordination Office. So you just have a code name by which and everything uses that. Well, I say everything should use that to work. Of course, it never actually works that way, but that's what we're aiming for. This one is health facilities in Beira. We're looking at locations of health facilities. In green, the ones in green are the ones that are actually opened. And the ones in yellow are the planned ones. So it's starting to map out some of the response capacity.
What capacity is there?
And I don't have it here, but the next map after this was showing cholera cases. So it was showing what the need is, the cholera cases, and what the help being provided is, which is the emergency clinics. We'll come back to that here. This map is sort of thematic overload. This is like an object lesson in why not to put four or five different themes onto one map. First, I still put it in here because it's got quite a few interesting concepts in it. First of all, it's got the same satellite-derived flooded areas in the blue shaded colours, maybe here. Second, this regular square grid is an assessment grid for aerial assessments. Because the road transport was more or less impossible because of flooding and just waterlogged roads, a lot of aerial assessments were done. The cells in green have been assessed according to some criteria by helicopter. The ones in white have not been assessed. The size of the blobs is population, estimated population of each settlement. And again, you've got to think, where do you get that data and how up to date is it? Then the colour of the blob is this severity scale, which is pretty subjective because it's been assessed with the air, but it's basically looking at how many buildings are destroyed in that or flooded or in uninhabitable in that town. So this is like a very early indication of not just where it needs to be focused, but how many people might be affected by population. And then finally, the different coloured lines is the road network. Green for open, orange is restricted access, and red is impossible. Again, you're probably thinking this is incredibly dynamic, it will change day to day, and it does. And so the team that we have, it works out we keep updating this as the information comes in. So this is just a quote from the agency we were working with. Again, this is just from our sort of corporate slides to show that the main message of this is that these information products, like maps, like data sets, are actually hugely important for decision making, operational decision making, like where to put aid, and also coordination. So when you've got 50 different agencies, they all need to be coordinated in terms of who's going to be delivering aid in which places. So I mentioned it's volunteers. I'll just go through now a bit about how we do that, how we go about delivering this service, having looked at that case study. The team's about 75, about half of them are what's called deployable, and that means they're trained, they've had their vaccinations, and they're in principle available to go at short notice to wherever the next disaster is. The other half, like me, they've got family commitments, or they've got work commitments, or for whatever reason, they can't actually deploy at the moment, but they're still there to help in the background. What's it actually like? This slide is the sort of extreme end of people looking a bit haggard and unshaven and unkempt. This was after 2 weeks in Haiti, after the 2010 earthquake. They devastated the country. They were in this tent at 35 degrees on the end of an airfield where there were big transport planes and helicopters landing every 10 minutes day and night. And it was, as I say, the extreme end of difficult conditions. And the laptops are covered in dust, and the keys don't work, and the printer doesn't work, and the paper in the printer is getting all wet and dusty. It could be. Having said that, that is the outline. In most cases, we are in I was, just by chance, I'd been in Pakistan three times every time we were in Islamabad, and we were accommodated in very swish marble offices, the big chandeliers of national disaster management agencies, all air conditioned, nice takeaway meals for lunch and dinner. And so I don't want to overdo the hardship, but it makes a good slide. Gives an idea what it's like sometimes. I mean, basically, it gives an idea what people have to be prepared for and trained for. This is Sierra Leone, landslide last year or the year before. The point of this is to show that we're always working in partnership. We can't just go to a country and do our stuff, because that A, could be unwelcome, B, it wouldn't be much use. So we only ever go anywhere if the national governments, usually through the Disaster Management Agency, request help, or it might come through the UN, who I've mentioned before, or it might come through an NGO like Oxfam, Save the Children, and the Niger one that Owen mentioned that I went on was with Oxfam after the floods there. I guess the main thing that means these partnerships are important is that we need to know what information they need to deliver an effective response. And if we have that partnership set up, then we can be much more effective in delivering that. We've got three ongoing regional partnerships in the Caribbean. This Caribbean in blue as well. It's the Caribbean Disaster Emergency Management Agency. This is the Central Asian which I can't quite remember, disaster response in Central Asia, and the ASEAN countries, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations Humanitarian Assistance Center, in Southeast Asia. So in those areas, we typically work through those partnerships. This next slide is a sort of concept for how GIS can be of help in a humanitarian response. I just put this in because you're a university audience. This is a slightly more conceptual model than I would normally present. So I'm going to present it first of all as our workflow. How does the team work? So it starts with data. We're using GIS to make maps, and I should say it's not the paper maps, it's the digital maps or the web maps. These maps go to the users, who are the humanitarian agencies, and they're using them ultimately for decision support. These products are informing them in decisions. And the result is better disaster response, possibly better disaster reduction, and doing training programs, preparedness programs. So that's the in principle the system that we're working on. And it's worth spelling this out because it's very easy to think, here's a map, it's useful, let's make it because of that. What we need to do is think, why is this going to be useful, who's it useful for, and what's the result going to be? So what I've done on this side is put an arrow going up, called the design process, that when we're designing a map or a map strategy, we're starting here, we're thinking, who are the users, what information do they need to help people in a disaster, and then work backwards and end up with the data. And it's all too common, I find, myself included. You think, here's a great data set, it's got coordinates, let's make a map of it and publish it. And then you think, well, what use was that? And you don't always know that it's relevant. So we're always focused on the endpoint. Okay, next slide, I'm going to go through this sort of activation process, like the nuts and bolts of how this all works. I've got a huge apology because I had a whole set of nice pictures to go through, which I managed to lose somehow in PowerPoint. So I'm going to do the thing that you're not supposed to do in PowerPoint, which is give you a screen full of text. So if you can just visualize this, please. You get a text message which says from the US Geological Survey that says there's been an earthquake, or there are hurricane alerting services that you can sign up to. How do you know that it's last it's happened? You can follow the news. So we have an office with a small staff in it, and they're monitoring all these things all the time to know what might be happening that might trigger as a climate. We then have to ask ourselves, should we respond to this? And this depends on, as I mentioned, who's requesting, is anyone requesting help? We need to do a risk assessment, of course, and it's a very real thing. It's not just like a totally paper exercise. We're thinking about the obvious things in terms of personal safety and security. If you know, is there any political threat to security? We're looking at diseases, accidents, all the things that can go wrong. And I've said contribution, what that means. Can we actually do anything useful in this situation? You know, if there's nothing we can do to help, there's not much more to go. Having said that, through experience, we have found that just by being there, you can almost always be useful. Because if you talk to the right people, you start to get relevant data, and you can make that into useful, actionable maps. As a climate action team member, I then get an email and a text alert saying, are you available to go in the next 24 hours or 48 hours? Let's say I reply and say, yes, I'm available. The staff then choose a team size at two people as a minimum. If it's a really big thing like Haiti, it's six or seven people. We'll get equipment from the storeroom. We'll get the ticket board for us to get insurance. We check all our dams are up to date and get on an aeroplane. Meanwhile, the other members of the team are swinging into interaction with what we call a data scramble. Data scramble makes it sound a bit disorganized, but part of it's urgent. It's actually pretty well organized. We all use a big shared Google spreadsheet and see who's collecting which data sets according to a list of which data sets we think are going to be helpful. We also keep quite a lot of base map data sort of on archive. So baseline population, terrain, administrative units, the sort of stuff that doesn't change too much. We also start looking for, if it's a hurricane, we get the hurricane track, usually from one of the American government hurricane tracking services, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Sources, where if it's an earthquake, US Geological Survey usually provides locations and shake intensity maps within minutes. If it's flooding, then we start to look for any flood products. Radar ones are often the first ones because they don't need clear skies, cloud penetrating radar. If we're lucky, we get optical ones as well. It's often the clouds where not the skies. So this data scramble, everything gets put on is uploaded onto a server and copied onto the laptops and gets sent off with the team. We can start to produce initial maps even before the team gets to the country. Initial maps that show baseline stuff, orientation maps for AIDS teams, population maps, the sort of thing I showed you for Mozambique. These maps which are quite useful just to get started. So by this stage, we've now got our team in the country. They've hopefully been met at the airport. said the first thing I put there is liaison. Actually the amount of sort of GIS work that they're doing, I don't know, it's probably like 20% of the time. A big chunk is making contact with relevant agencies who are doing field assessments. I was in Nepal after the big earthquake in 2015, and the Nepali Red Cross, Red Crescent, was doing a huge amount of work on the ground and collecting information. They weren't reporting it openly, they were using it themselves and doing fantastic work. But in order to make that information useful to the aid community as a whole, we had to go to the Red Cross, talk to them, and they were totally willing to share that, the information they were collecting about where they were responding. Sometimes agencies are more protective about information. They're not the kind of sharing mentality. In which case we need to, you know, oil the wheels as much as possible. So liaison data collation. I say collation, not collection. We ourselves do very little data. As field data collection, there's a huge amount of data cleaning that comes into play. Say you've got numbers of people or numbers of houses that have been damaged or destroyed reported in each district by different agencies. Everyone's using different standards for reporting, typically. They're using different administrative structures or units to do that reporting. They're using different coordinate systems or coordinate formats, different spellings, and so on. So there's always a lot of data cleaning involved. I always feel very like I'm sort of driving a data Rolls Royce when I do work in the UK, like from the National Statistical Office or Census Data. It's all there. It's all like clean and in nice tidy columns and ready to use. And it just feels so easy compared to having to work for days getting the data all nice and clean. And then, in a sense, the map production bit is the easy bit. You're actually putting this on a map. Generally, this works very well. While this team is busy clearing away in the country, I should say this team, even if they're in a nice, comfortable office, they're generally working like 14-hour days. It's really intense. The demands are just incessant. Typically, there's a coordination meeting at 8 o'clock in the morning. If I think of the Nepal earthquake example, there would be one big coordination meeting at 8 o'clock in the morning. They would want maps showing the previous day's latest situation in time for 8 in the morning, which means you have to be up till midnight the night before getting those maps ready. They want them on paper, so you need to allow 2 hours to print them. So that means you map ready by 10 o'clock. The print is probably going to go wrong, so I didn't want your map ready by 9 o'clock, which means you have an hour for actually making the map, which means you need another 5 hours for cleaning the data. And suddenly it's the day before, and it becomes a bit overwhelming. So it's hard work. So luckily we have the rest of the team, or those available, and we can throw back some of the work to them. What do we do with the maps? Well, the frontline users are the people who are working alongside in our office. Often we set up a sort of map centre with someone at the front of house, as it were. So people will come along, someone from MSF will come along, or from the Red Cross, or from the local NGO, and say, do you have a map showing which roads are still open in the Gorkha Valley in Nepal? Or you get as we did in Nepal, you get a helicopter pilot coming in from a big US NGO like World Vision, saying, we need coordinates in this valley for where we can land our helicopters. That sort of request is fantastic for us because we can very directly provide assistance to them using some satellite imagery or using air fuel databases. that information. So we have this sort of map desk operating, but then we're also distributing maps through the website, and then it does totally open access, anyone can look at them, you know, sort of classified by theme and by country and by date and so on. And of course, increasingly using road mapping to present maps or to present data as a service. As we go along, we're constantly thinking, how can we improve this? What other partners can we involve? And usually towards the end, like after this 2 week into a 4 or 6 week period, we're thinking, we need to hand over now. Other agencies now have a capacity to take over. We exist because no one really existed in this immediate response niche, in this window. And typically we will find that the National Disaster Management Agency is very keen to take over the GIS capacity. So we have a very structured way of keeping all our data. I should have said that before. There's a standard file naming convention, standard folders that everybody knows, standard map naming conventions, which are all documented. So it's relatively easy to hand this over to another agency with the documentation. Sometimes we're handing over to a new agency. Sometimes we find that the activity just ends and that's that. But ideally we wanted this function to be able to continue. And then after the team returns, we may continue some remote support. But typically we want to have some sort of measure of the impact. How much use was all that effort? It's really hard to measure this. It's really hard to know how was this map used to contribute to this outcome. And it's an interesting question just to think about yourself. When it's like a helicopter landing site, there's a very clear link between the map and the result. If the pilot was able to land 20 tons of food to the valley, so people had food. If it's a map showing how many agencies are working in each district, say in providing medical services, it's really, everyone says that's useful, but it's very hard to actually demonstrate the pathway from the map to the humanitarian outcome. We're still working on that. We look at the lessons learned, what can we do better next time, and we archive all the data, so the data we collect is available for the next time. So, sorry, there's my text-rich slide all over. Could you be visualising that? I'll just go through these very quickly, just example maps. Basically, the question I'm trying to ask you is, what use are these maps? What sort of purposes do maps serve? As I've alluded to before. To me, this is the sort of the nub of humanitarian mapping. It's comparing the needs of people with the provision. And if there's a gap between those, you know, perhaps the need is that much in a location, and the provision is that much in a location, you've got this gap. And that's what needs to be filled. So in my mind, this is what we're aiming for. What was this? I've forgotten where this was, my question. Does anyone recognize that shape? Thank you. So water supply. So I guess this was one of the hurricanes, October 2017. How much water was provided in the last 5 days? This is how many days water remains for those communities. In other words, how much time do they have before fresh water runs out? And you know, the concept's very simple, but the actual amount of data to get to that is enormous. It's not the data that suddenly appears, especially when your communications and transport infrastructure are crumbling. This is actually quite something quite similar, water supplies in camps, displaced people's camps in Indonesia. I mentioned storm tracks. Which one was this? September 2018. So, anticipated storm tracks across the Atlantic. Oh, this one was, this was very useful mapping. So locations of emergency treatment centres for bird cases in West Africa. Is this Liberia, I think? I was working in Sierra Leone. So we've got the numbers of cases shown by the colours, and then the response treatment centres and their capacity to treat people also shown on the map. So again, you've got this concept of what's the demand and what's the provision to meet that demand for help. This is Ecuador. I wasn't involved in this at all. Ecuador earthquake. So this is the sort of map that we want to get out immediately. It's urban search and rescue coordination. Basically, when there's a big earthquake, loads of countries like to pile in with their highly trained, highly equipped search and rescue teams. It's like a high profile. It's a bit difficult to say publicity stuff, but it's something that always happens in earthquakes. Everyone wants to go provide help. Although, in terms of lives saved, actually the numbers are very small in this initial search and rescue phase. The numbers saved by international teams, I should say, because they're taking 24 hours to get in. Most lives are saved by local people digging, putting people out. Anyway, coordinating these teams is really important. So, dividing up a town or a country into sectors and saying, Turkish team, you go there, Russian team, you go there, and so on. And so, we actually get very involved in the earthquake search and rescue coordination. This happened in Haiti. We did some really horrible maps in Haiti of search and rescue sectors because we were doing them in like 10 minutes and people were phoning in and saying, you team just arrived, they're going to such and such a town. So we just put it on the map. So cartographically it was extremely challenged, but functionally these maps were really useful coordination tools. So don't worry if your map doesn't look very nice. Hurricane Matthew, this is in Haiti again. This is sort of basic infrastructure map showing roads. Having said that, we're focused on disaster response, we're increasingly getting called on to provide training and capacity building around the world. So agencies become aware of the potential for GIS and related technologies, and now that hardware and software and data are all becoming much more accessible, particularly with open source, it's something that almost anyone can do with the right support. In a sense, the learning the software is the easy bit. Most of the capacity building and training we do is in procedures and workflows. It's how to set up a structure and a system for responding quickly to an emergency in a structured way. So we do a lot of work with that. This was one of the Caribbean ones. And this is in Almaty, in Kazakhstan, doing capacity building with that regional centre I mentioned earlier. What I'd like to just mention now to finish off with is a collaboration we've had with Geosciences in Edinburgh, initially through Eliza Calder, who's a volcanologist. And she was looking for a way to make volcanic hazard maps more relevant. So instead of Volcanological Institute making a hazard map as a PDF and having it on file, how could this actually be useful to people living around that volcano and to NGOs who might help respond or prepare to an eruption, respond or prepare for that eruption, and for local governments perhaps. They probably don't have access to those maps, and they probably don't have the means to actually make them useful. So we worked together to starting off in Guatemala, to take these maps and to put them onto a 3D web map using our GIS online. So it wasn't, technically it wasn't a huge undertaking, but what we found was that, amazingly, as far as we can tell, no one had done this before. No one had put volcanic hazards online on a 3D mapping platform like this. And the response was really positive. And as a result, we got some funding to extend this to several other countries. And actually, one of last year's master's students, Catherine, sitting here, did a lot of this work in the Caribbean, several islands. And the sort of background to this was a story that Alison knows much more about than I do, is that as well as just showing the risk or the objective hazard posed by that volcano, what are the social, economic, political factors that make different communities vulnerable in different ways? And after Fuego erupted last year, they did a very interesting study of how three or four different communities, which were in the same hazard zone, were all affected very differently from those who were evacuated with no casualties to those who suffered a lot of fatalities and had their livelihoods and their houses entirely destroyed. And this was all related to how much people were able to access information, what sort of relationships they had with local governments, what sort of communications they had, what sort of ethnic aspects there were to this. And it was a really interesting example of how you need to look at all these different factors as well as just the volcanic risk. And so through this, it's an ongoing process of trying to map not just the volcanic risks but also the factors that affect vulnerability. I'm going to just skip over to a webcam to show you this. This is a work in progress. This is our home page at the moment, which shows the various volcanoes in different countries that we've worked on. This is basically Eliza and colleagues wrote to the Volcanological Institute in each of these countries. Do they have good relationships with them? He said, would you like to do this sort of mapping? And amazingly, all of these ones came back and said, yes, please. And we're ready to share our data. And I'm hoping this is going to be a jumping off point for much more collaboration with them. Anyway, I'll jump over to the volcanoes. We'll go to the Fuego one.
Probabilistic hazard zones. And the uniqueness of this map is interactive, so all these layers at the right margin, you can combine different other maps and also population data. So I'm in a perspective way. So what we did, I'm a PhD student here at the University of Edinburgh, and we went and field with some of these printouts to the communities, and the fact that they were perspective and they could see the volcano as they see it in normal day-to-day life was much was more understandable by people who don't necessarily have an experience with looking at maps. Yeah, and it, you can also combine like the red or pinkish with flow with the pyroclastic flow in June last year. You can also, there's a Lahar map, which is another volcanic hazard.
Thank you very much. This is like another whole other seminar itself. Yeah. Useful and interesting work. And the fact that the local communities were engaging in these maps is hugely important, because the way we can go forward now is to actually work out contingency plans and start to build resilience, to use the buzzword, in those communities. How can we get there to alert to likely eruptions? What can we do if there's an eruption? What facilities, what infrastructure needs to be improved, like roads or simply being able to get text alerts that something's going on? And actually, so this is the map that Catherine did for the master project of St. Vincent. Yeah. And this one actually has a lot more of the infrastructure, social data on it in various different layers that you can see here. So facilities like clinics, community centres, fire stations, schools could be used as evacuation centres. You've got emergency shelters, police stations, PCA, what was PCA?
It's the Butler Limits Capacity System.
Okay.
The Red Cross.
Thank you.
Capacity System.
Yes. So being able to identify areas that are vulnerable for whatever reason.
Yeah, they were looking at what vulnerabilities and then what capabilities each village have.
Yeah.
And perhaps where that gap is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. So this just shows the sort of work that we're doing now, and there's a lot of work progress in this work with local partners. So I wanted to mention that because that was a nice example of how all this work is really useful and applied, and how it's connected with work that's going on here in Edinburgh. So thank you all very much for very
say that the 3D model will eventually
over confusing, but
I feel it depends on the audience you're trying to engage. It does seem to work very successfully with a lot of people who wouldn't really engage with a flat map. And even actually we found while I was trying to print out of a perspective map, actually can work better than just a flat map. So I'd say it depends on the audience. Courses for courses. I don't know if anyone else has thoughts on that.
Yeah, I
How close are you working with the ESA or UN Spider? Because they're providing the data, I guess.
Yes, ESA, European Space Agency. Is it Sentinel? Their program. Do you know that?
Yeah.
They actually have a disaster response system called. With the Sentinel satellite, and Copernicus is the program, I think, is that right?
Yeah.
And they do very quick satellite-derived products. So we I would say we work closely with them, but we use their products a lot. Mm-hmm. Do you know that?
I just wanted to ask,
because
it's great to work together.
Yes. Yeah. And often we will get in touch and say, nice map, can we have the data for that, please? They used to provide it.
Yes, so I kind of guess one of the questions kind of follow. You share some really nice map views with somebody. Contributed some amounts of blood instead of writing the data.
Oh, yes, yes.
Work producing the data that just says this is where the blood is. It's not insignificant. Is that work you undertake?
Volunteers, or do you rely on other people publishing, partnerships, organizations
that do this
sort of
organization?
The short answer is we totally depend on other people for this sort of thing. Because I remember we were in touch with you, thank you very much. Because derived flood extents of standard water from radar or optimetry is basically very difficult, and also distinguishing it from what you expect to be standing water, like a lake or a river, and taking into account seasonal variations. So people like you who developed algorithms to do that depend on a lot, and another partner there is UNOSAT, as nations, satellite technologies. We also do similar work. So yeah, for specialist processing, sometimes if we happen to have a person who knows that topic, like landslide, we've got someone who did a PhD in landslide processes, we can do some stuff ourselves. Partnerships are very big for the specialist stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for the presentation. I love the work I'm actually does. I'm coming more from the consumption end of these maps. Because there's a neatness, which you will agree with me, is actually not the way it is when we look at how these maps get used. Because you mentioned Nepal, and in 2015 there were 200 humanitarian organizations that had landed there after the earthquake. And that was a huge problem, because not only had a reputation of organizations on the ground, I also saw there were two different layers to it. One was there's a lot of discussion on online mapping and humanitarian mapping happening at the level of the UN.
Yes.
But in terms of people going and distributing relief supplies and other networks, the circulation of this very information that was being produced online was very limited.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you must have seen the same.
Yeah.
The scale is different between that in terms of what we were talking about and what was actually happening on the ground. It bothers me about how we can work on this front to make this work. So your thoughts on this would be awesome.
Yeah. Well, it's a really big and good question. I'm constantly very aware of that, because it's very easy to get lost in the sort of cloud of technology and online services at a high level that are quite disconnected with what's going on on the ground. But I think we're often some slightly varying extent not doing very well in that respect. actually, there's a report which I was to show that the people on time, this goes back to 2013, humanitarian needs in northern Syria, which was the area that was being held by the rebels at the time. And we did the maps for this report and did all the data collation. And this report was trying to show that in a very clear way what the needs were. So intensity of conflict. We did the tables as well. Yeah, so it's quite graphical. It's sort of overlap of graphics and maps. And trying to communicate things in a simpler way. But we're constantly trying to find ways of doing exactly that. And the way that was the whole point of the volcanic mapping project was how to convey some quite technical concepts to people who could use them. Did you have more thoughts about it? Options people want. They really do map where you can choose which layer of it to get. Basically, they want someone to provide them with the information that is useful to them. And so paper map, or JPEG, or PDF actually does that. Which is interesting. With that, they've got demands. That demand is at the same level. I'd say that has to be increased in sort. At the same time, there is an increasing demand for online maps where you can actually choose which layers you want, much more like the one we showed here for the Caribbean and Guatemala. I guess with the emergencies, we've, over the years, we've got to know what information different types of decision makers want, and so we can provide that. But here we are getting increasingly resistant. We feel a bit like we're not getting up with our web offer. At the same time, we feel we're not missing a huge trick either. But it's a really big and interesting question.
Yeah. There are possibilities, though, that looks to be a good
coming. There is another joint talk again later with you, continuing next week. This joint talk, I think it's the 28th of November, similar week. So that should be Wilson from EGS, Scaling Engine.